Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, an influencer network, a magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @blogosphereM. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Harry Berridge, who is an intellectual assets manager at legal firm Stobbs. Harry specialises in fashion.
My name is Harry Berridge and I am a trademark attorney, so I work in brand protection and IP.
Brilliant. And can you tell us a little bit about your background? How have you ended up at Stobbs? Let's take it back. Did you study law at university?
I actually didn't study law at university. I always swore that I would never be a lawyer, in fact. Both my parents were lawyers, and I wouldn't say that they necessarily put me off law, but it wasn't necessarily a career that appealed to me, and I certainly didn't think that I would end up going into law and becoming a lawyer. So I read art history at university, and I was definitely more of a creative person.
What happened? What changed?
I graduated in 2008, which many people will remember was quite a challenging time to graduate.
Recession.
Due to the recession. So I graduated and I was offered a role in a law firm as a paralegal, and I took it. I still didn't think that law was going to be ultimately what I wanted to do, but I felt that, you know, I needed a job. The arts and creative industries are nearly always the hardest hit during recessions, so I felt like this was a good option for me in the meantime. I took the job and I enjoyed it. I wouldn't say that I necessarily enjoyed all the aspects of working for a law firm. And I did get left with a bit of a negative impression in relation to the way those types of law firms are run and managed. But I did really enjoy the day-to-day work and the legal work that I was doing.
Was that culture or was that hours?
I think it was a bit of both. I didn't particularly enjoy the way that women were viewed and treated in the firm. And I also found the hierarchical structure of the firm quite difficult. The way that partners treated associates and associates treated paralegals, it wasn't always that pleasant. So in some ways it was quite a kind of toxic environment. But I did really, despite that, I did enjoy the job itself and decided to do my law conversion, and so I did that, and I still didn't necessarily think that I would go into law, then I was having a conversation with a friend who kind of mentioned the option of IP law to me.
Just for our creators who are listening, and you know, IP, intellectual property,
a career in trademarks, which wasn't something that I had previously considered, but I felt like it fitted well with my creative background, and it was at that point that I really started to seriously explore a career in IP. I started to actively look for roles within the IP industry. I didn't really know at the time that you could specialise in trademarks and just kind of be a trademark attorney. So I looked into the career more, and I realised that I felt that it would fit perfectly with my more creative side, but also combining it with my legal skills that I gained over the years.
But also history of art, because they were trademarked with their signatures, weren't they?
Exactly right. Yeah, so being able to combine history of art and also thinking about history of art, you've also got copyright, so copyright and art. So it really appealed to me on a lot of different levels. And yeah, I was lucky enough to be offered a job at Stobbs by Julius Stobbs, who owns and manages Stobbs.
And that's Julia Stobbs.
Julius Stobbs.
Julia Stobbs.
So I joined Stobbs in 2012. So this is my 10th year working with the firm.
Wow.
And I trained at the firm and qualified in 2015. So I've really been on my IP journey at Stobbs. And I must say that it's restored my faith in the legal profession.
Because in terms of how long Stobbs has been going, it's not a really old firm, is it?
You're right. Actually, Stobbs itself was founded in 2013. When I actually joined Stobbs, it wasn't even Stobbs. It was a different firm. But then Julius founded Stobbs in 2013, kind of wanting to take a different approach to IP protection and set up a different kind of IP law firm. We really want to be thought of more as a brand protection consultancy or a brand consultancy, which can assist brands and individuals at every stage of the kind of life cycle.
And how many people are within the team now, and how many, you know, it's intellectual property, but how many sort of different verticals within that does the firm sort of cover?
When Stobbs was first founded, I believe there were around 16 people working at the firm, including myself. And today we have over 170 people working for the firm.
Wow.
So it really has grown exponentially during those 10 years, which I think is a testament to the type of firm that Julius has created and the fact that it is actually a different type of law firm. And to go back to your point, Alice, on the different offerings, in order to create the type of firm that Julius really wanted to build, which was a firm that can really help brands at every stage of their life cycle, you know, that requires different functions throughout that life cycle. And I think what's really unique about Stobbs is that we aim to provide different services to support brands at every stage of the journey. And some of those functions are not legal functions. For example, we have a brand licensing expert called Esther. She is not from a legal background, but she has a wealth of experience in licensing. And so she can assist brands with licensing. We have a brand valuation consultancy that is part of Stobbs. And then right at the other end of the spectrum, at the very beginning, we partner very closely with a creative agency called Heavenly. So if brands are looking for assistance in the creative naming process, that would be where Heavenly comes in. And then everything in between that, on the brand protection and enforcement side, we have various functions to kind of assist with that, including an online brand enforcement team, specialists in customs and anti-counterfeiting, because fashion, you know, really spans all of these things. That's what's sort of unique about fashion brands.
Because we're talking about brands there, but as we know and have seen increasingly that, see, Serious Influence, we're about the influencer industry. The influencers are becoming brands in their own right. Well, they are brands in their own right, but then also creating, you know, say, an athleisure wear company, a footwear company. So there's the extension of their brands as well. I think when creators first start getting into deals and using themselves as brands, it's mainly in brand collaboration. So if a creator was doing a brand deal with a different brand, could they come to you, to Stobbs for advice on that contract?
Absolutely. And in fact, I would really advise any creative influencer, individual or young brand, if they are entering into any form of legal contract, that it is a really good idea to seek legal advice in relation to that contract before signing anything. Very often when you're starting out in the industry, there is a tendency to want to try to say yes to everything, take every opportunity, but that shouldn't be at the detriment of your rights, and it is really important to make sure that when you're dealing with brands who might be in a relative position of power, in terms of, you know, they are the brand, they will likely have lawyers looking over their contracts and negotiating them, that you're putting yourself in the best possible position as well. And so I would really advise seeking legal advice before signing a contract.
Do you think that there, you know, if you're just professionalising and getting your first few brand deals and say you don't have a talent manager, that there are ways to access legal advice that aren't prohibitively expensive for creators?
I think it is difficult. You know, legal services do tend to be very expensive. One of the things that I'm really trying to do at Stobbs, as a fashion specialist in IP, is try to offer advice to creatives, influencers, young designers, graduates, who may not feel that they have access to legal services, trying to offer support to those types of individual in a cost-effective way that they can access easily, giving them clear, pragmatic advice, which I think is really important. Yeah.
And they could be a high-value customer in the future when things sort of snowball.
Exactly right. You never know how a brand is going to develop and where it's going to go. So I think it's really important to invest in these people and show them the value of IP and show them that in a clear way that they can really use, and not just bombarding them with legal scenarios and things that they may not understand, but trying to give that to them in a cost-effective way that's actually helpful to them. You know, unfortunately, we see all too often the scenario where the fashion graduate straight out of university gets an internship with a well-known brand. They go to the brand, they share their ideas, they leave the internship, and then 3 months later they see elements of their work or their ideas being used by the brand, and they haven't given permission for that, and it's really unfair. A fashion retailer just literally stealing independent designers' ideas and passing them off as their own. And it is a really common issue across the fashion industry, but one that we at Stobbs are trying to support the independent designers and brands try to combat a bit of that activity.
We have seen that so many times. I've seen so many tweets from creators who were, sort of blogging on the side and then went to job interviews, did these briefs, and then only for the whole campaigns to then be running.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, it can be quite disheartening for people if that happens, and they lose faith in IP and its value. But honestly, having decent IP rights in place is something that will put you in good stead if you are having those discussions with brands.
So being able to put that sort of legislation into, how does one protect their IP?
So it depends a little bit on how, what the person's doing, whether they're a designer, whether they're developing a retail brand, whether they're a creative, an influencer, which is obviously kind of what we're mainly talking about today. So for an influencer, kind of one of the main things that we would look to protect is your name as a trademark. That's kind of a really important first step. It's really interesting because in the UK we don't have rights of image or image rights as other jurisdictions actually have that written into legislation, but in the UK we don't actually have a legislative framework around image rights. This makes it slightly more challenging in the UK for creatives and influencers who are relying quite heavily on the publication of their image to enforce against misuse of that image. And it just means that if they're looking to, control use of the image or taking action against misuse of it, they're really forced to look at other ways and means of doing that via other IP mechanisms, such as, copyright, passing off, or use of your name via trademark infringement proceedings.
So what does that mean then, that people can just take...
As I've already said, protecting your name as a trademark, or if you go by a nickname, sort of a shortening of your name, ideally you would protect both your name and that shortening, and ensure that you have both those protected as a trademark. It's also worth noting that trademarks are protected for certain goods and services, so you do want to take some time and care ensuring that you have actually protected your trademark for the right goods and services, and also that there is an element of future-proofing going on around that, so thinking about what you might want to do with your name in the future rather than just protecting it for the kind of things that you're doing in the present.
So say if you have your name that you go by online and you want to create a fashion brand that goes under that name as well, but you haven't trademarked it within beauty, somebody else could bring out beauty line under your name.
Exactly right. I mean, in that scenario, there may well be, something that you can do that would mean that wouldn't happen. But yes, essentially, it's just ensuring that you are future-proofing your brand. And I think for creatives operating in the fashion industry, really, it's, the most common brand extensions are going to be cosmetic ranges, and fashion goods, so that might be clothing, but also fashion accessories is likely to be kind of the core areas. So it's just making sure that you're protecting yourself for those specific classes, and as well as the kind of advertising and publicity type services that you will be offering as an influencer. I also think it's really important that when you're making those decisions and having those discussions, that you engage a professional to help guide you through what you should and shouldn't be thinking about in terms of trademark protection or any kind of IP protection.
When I'm just talking about, say, a brand collaboration, earlier on in the series of the podcast, I was speaking to Mel Kentish, who's the global head of influencer at Sky. And when I was asking her what her biggest red flags for agencies were, it was anyone that wants to own the IP. So there are influencer marketing agencies that are trying to own the IP of the creator and then sell it into the brand. Does that sound quite bad to you?
Yeah, so I would agree that any contract where you're being asked to give away your IP when that isn't something that you'd intended to do would be a red flag.
And that IP is, say, if it's a brand campaign, that's the image that you've created for the campaign, or is that something else, or can be something else?
So in general, the IP will be set out in any contract, but for creatives and influencers, I think the main form of IP will be the content that they are creating for the brand. They will own copyrights in that contract, in that content, and obviously they want to be able to retain rights in the ownership of that content so that they can retain rights on how that content is used by the brand moving forward, and to ensure that it's used in the way that they would want it to be used.
And why an agency might be interested in trying to gain control of that IP is that the campaign could run, but then say it gets around to a launch the following year, it's Christmas season, they have a piece of Christmas content and they haven't commissioned lots of new stuff but would quite want to run something. When it's out of the contract, they can then relicense it but they would get paid and the creator wouldn't. Is that a possible scenario?
Yes, and I think another possible issue there is reputational damage. So if an influencer has very strong leanings towards sustainable fashion businesses or ethical practices, and that's really part of the image that they want to project to consumers, and they carefully select brands that follow those types of initiatives and practices, they produce content, they sign a contract which effectively gives up control of that, of the IP in that content, and the brand then uses that content in a way that they don't agree with or don't like, and which goes against their beliefs in terms of sustainability or ethics or whatever it might be, then it makes it much, much harder for them to prevent that type of use going forward. So I think those kinds of reputational issues for influencers are also something to be aware of and consider.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got retained control of the IP in this kind of hypothetical contract that you're looking out for. This is what you want. And then you want to make sure that the license agreement and the timing of it is clear. Then what else have we got? We've got some approval rights. What would you say on that?
So yes, rights of approval is basically who has final right of approval over any content that is being produced or created for the brand by the creative or the influencer.
Yeah.
And putting into place clear mechanisms for both parties on how that process will work, who will get final right of approval, and ensuring that it's clear for both parties.
Yeah, I suppose from a creator's perspective, if there are, approvals, that maybe that sort of also needs to have a limit on how many times they can go back and approve, because otherwise you're being paid for creating one piece of content. But, if you've had six different iterations, that's more time.
Exactly right. So, the influencer doesn't want to be in a position where they have an onerous undertaking regarding approval, but equally they probably want to be in a position where they are able to retain control over final approval to ensure they're happy with it, but also it needs to work for the brand as well. The brand also needs to be comfortable.
Yeah. And then exclusivity, are they often clauses about exclusivity put into contracts?
Yes, so exclusivity is an important one actually. So clauses around exclusivity effectively determine whether an influencer can work for one brand and also work for other brands at the same time, or whether they must work exclusively for one brand at a time. And in particular, this would cover a scenario where you're working for a brand, producing content, you're in a contract with that brand, and one of their competitors comes along and thinks, we quite like what you're doing with them, we would like you to do that for us, can you come and do that for us please, whether the influencer is ultimately free to do that or whether they're prevented from doing that through the exclusivity clauses in the agreement.
I think definitely that is important for creators who are working on a campaign by campaign basis, as opposed to those who have been sort of cast within ambassador schemes, on which we're seeing more and more now. But you don't want to be working for, say, a beauty brand when you're working campaign by campaign, and then be prevented from talking about lipstick for 6 months. Just getting termination clauses. What should those be? I mean, always have a. If you don't pay, basically, I suppose.
Right. So again, termination clauses are also extremely important. They determine the circumstances under which either the brand or the influencer can terminate the contract if there is a breach in contract. So you mentioned payment, Alice, and that is right. If the brand is not paying the influencer, generally speaking, you'd expect to see that as a reason to terminate. Also, I referred to reputational issues before. So I think in terms of influencer contracts, this would be another important area or reason to terminate a contract on both sides. I think often the reputational issues will probably feel more relevant or more important to the brand, just because the nature of being an influencer does mean that they will very often be perhaps looking at alternative brand deals, maybe working with brands that the original brand don't particularly like, etc., etc. But I think it really works both ways. So I referred to the scenario before where an influencer has you know, strong sustainability leanings, and then they're working for a brand that perhaps changes its angle and strongly goes against those types of practices. That might be a scenario where the influencer feels that their reputation is going to be damaged because that's not the image that they want to project to the public. So in those scenarios, it would be making sure that either party can terminate the contract if they feel that the reputation of the brand, or if the influencer feels that their own reputation as an influencer is at stake. I would also say that whether you are a lawyer or a legal person, whether you've looked at a contract before, it's always a good idea to read the contract and think to yourself, is this a balanced contract? Does it benefit the parties equally? If you're seeing in a contract that there are clauses that allow the brand to terminate a contract but don't give you the same opportunity to terminate, so a reciprocal clause, then to me that should be a red flag. It's, you know, contracts are there to protect both parties, but I do think, again, when you're entering into this industry, you are in perhaps a slightly weaker position as against a large brand who again may have lawyers negotiating for them. So just making sure that the contract feels balanced, and that you're seeing that, you know, if the brand can do something, that that you are able to also do that thing. So termination is a really important clause there. So just making sure that the brand can't terminate the contract with no notice and without giving any reasons.
I remember we hosted a panel at an event back in 2019, and on the panel was someone who worked for a huge organisation, and we got on to contracts. And some of the terms that were in there were incredibly one-sided for them. And the other creators that were on the panel sort of was like, well, that's very strange. And this person sort of said, well, it's in our interest to try and get in as much as possible. And I think it was about around licensing and owning rights and things. So, but I think within the creator industry, the whole sort of IP licensing has really grown a lot in the last sort of 2 years, and the awareness piece around it. And so people are getting more savvy to contracts.
Yes, I think you're right. And I think probably now the profession is much more regulated, and I think influencers are becoming much more savvy. They are business people, and I think the importance of contracts has just really grown over the years as the creative industry has grown. The use of contracts simply reflects that position, and I think when the industry was in its infancy, these deals were probably being done very informally, but ultimately that might end up benefiting the brand. You know, if there's not a contract, you know, who said what? It could really go either way. But I think it is important that influencers are recognising the importance of contracts for them, but only if they're getting the right advice around those and making sure that the terms of the contract are favourable to them.
Well, yeah, the industry is definitely professionalising, and I think, you know, lots of creators do have talent managers as well, so it's, you know, they're going to be represented by them, and one of the things that, you know, that office is that influencer talent agency will have access, you know, to a legal firm.
Exactly, and I think it's really important that they do have access to those legal services in order to protect themselves in future.
In terms of payments, we do see quite a big problem with creators not being paid on time. Is there some, you know, there's 30-day payment terms, but you get some companies that are, sort of do 60, 90. When, what can creators sort of put into contracts if that, you know, they could terminate it, but in some, and sometimes it's they get paid after the content's produced. So I know that there are, or people do talk about adding on, you know, interest for late payment, but is there anything else that people can do?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. Payment is, you know, at the end of the day, it's one of the most important things about the relationship is that the influencer is being paid properly by the brand. I think, as you've said, making sure that there are payment terms in the contract is really important, even if the brand doesn't always follow those payment terms. But also thinking about whether it's a good idea to split the payments. So you may perhaps end up getting paid some of the content at the outset before the content is produced, when the brand has approved the content perhaps even, and then actually when the content is delivered and published, the remainder of the payment would be given to the influencer at that point.
I know some creators that do that. Yeah, there's 50% upfront. Interesting. Now, liability, we're talking about red flags, so we've sort of covered that we shouldn't have IP licenses, be wary of vague terms, think about exclusivity, approval rights, but as a broad indemnity wording with no liability cap, what does that mean?
Yes, so again, liability clauses, indemnity clauses and warranties are all really important and should be reviewed very carefully in any contract. So warranties are effectively statements or they are things that the influencer is effectively telling the brand to be true. They are warranting to the brand certain things. For example, you know, they own the IP and they are giving the brand the right to use it, and they are warranting that by doing that the brand is not going to be exposed to an infringement claim by a third party. Now, one issue that I can see here being a common issue in this area is it, you know, that's fine where the influencer is creating the content themselves. As we've already discussed, when that is the case, they will own the copyright in that content, and so it shouldn't be too problematic. They are giving a warranty that they own the IP and that the brand is free to use the content. Where it becomes slightly more difficult is where the influencer might use IP, someone else's IP, such as a photograph where a different photographer has taken the photograph, or other types of content, videography, whatever, that hasn't been actually created by the influencer and has been created by a third party. And in that scenario, the influencer may find themselves in trouble if they warrant to the brand that they are free to use the content, the brand publishes the content, and then the owner of the IP, say the photographer or the person that produced the content, then takes issue with it and contacts the brand and says, "You're infringing my IP." So that's the type of situation that we would be looking to avoid, and why it is really, really important to be clear about who owns the IP if you are creating or using images that haven't been created by you. Then you need to make sure that you have permission to use those images to in your own content. And you may even need to have a contract in place with the photographer or whatever to ensure that that is the case. And then indemnity provisions are effectively what you are indemnifying the brand if such an infringement situation arises. So effectively you are giving an indemnity that if the brand does suffer damage or an infringement action, that you will indemnify them the cost of that damage, or the worst case scenario, if there was no liability cap, is that you may end up having to foot the bill to see those infringement proceedings through to a conclusion, which honestly is probably not going to be possible or feasible for influencers who are just starting out just because of the high cost. But it really is something that you want to avoid. So I think often it's a good idea to think about what's, you know, it's very likely that a brand will want to have some sort of liability or indemnities within the contract, but it would be a good idea for the influencer to think about what that risk and exposure is, and perhaps agree that the risk should not be greater than the fee that's being paid by the brand, so limiting their own liability under the contract to an amount that's equal to the fee. And yeah, making sure that those liability caps apply to any indemnities that are contained within the contract.
So one of the things that we also see quite often is, say that a creator has done a photo shoot with a photographer, and the photographer's put that onto their Instagram page, that then a news organisation will take the image and put it within an article. And so you see a lot of photographers getting quite cross about that because the copyright belongs to them. I believe a copyright, actually, well, speaking to a lawyer, but I believe there was this is my journalism like law bit, that copyright for photographers changed in about 88, so that the photographer, before that it used to be the person that had commissioned it, but then it rests with the photographer and you have to buy it. But what kind of, that might be wrong, so I will fact check that. But what can a photographer do in that instance?
So I think that's a difficult scenario, and particularly where it's referential use by in a news article, and the publisher has reproduced the photograph but has properly attributed it to the photographer and has included proper references to the photographer or the person that ultimately owns the IP. That's quite difficult to stop. One thing that we see a lot in our work in IP, particularly on the online brand enforcement side though, which is very relevant to fashion, is where a brand has produced their own photography, you know, taking photographs of products on models or photographs of products, to put on their website, obviously to market and sell those goods. And obviously they've put quite a lot of money into those photographs to make them look nice and appealing to customers. And then we have these copycat websites or infringing websites that literally lift those photographs and reproduce them on the infringing website to sell, kind of either to sell counterfeit goods or actually set up to facilitate payment fraud, whatever the reason might be. Generally speaking, when you're dealing with infringing websites, the reason behind them doesn't tend to be good. But yeah, that's a really common issue. So a brand in that scenario would then have an actionable cause under copyright infringement for use of its images without authorisation.
And that is sort of saying, look, I'm going to fine you if you don't take it down.
Yeah, so effectively it would be writing to the infringing website and requesting that they remove the content and provide undertakings that they're not going to do it again in the future.
Interesting. So I feel like we've covered the contract quite well. Now I'm moving on from a perspective of, I am a fashion creator and I want to launch my own clothing brand. I am very creative. I know what I want to produce, but how do I... legally, what legal things do I need to think about, and how can I make this a reality?
Honestly, there is a lot to consider, and I feel like I could honestly speak about this with you for 3 hours, much longer than we've got to here to talk about it.
But what people can do after the podcast is, you actually have, I believe, your own Instagram account where you talk about things like this.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So at Stobbs, we've set up an Instagram account called Intangible Threads, which I've set up with my co-worker Emma Day. The purpose of Intangible Threads is really to be a platform where we can connect with the types of individuals and businesses that we're discussing today, Alice. So creatives, influencers, young designers, young graduates, startup fashion businesses of all shapes and sizes, but trying to give them legal information and tips in a way that's a bit more accessible to them. But to go back to your question on what people should be thinking about when they're first setting up a brand, I think it really always does depend slightly on the type of brand that you are looking to set up. But most commonly, influencers will be setting up a brand under, you know, their own name or a variation of their own name. So some considerations around that. Whether you actually want to launch your brand using your name as it is, or whether you're going to create a new brand name in order to launch the brand under that instead.
What do you think's best with that? Because I know that Jo Malone, she's sort of sold basically her name, and now she has JoJo Loves, I think. But there was some fallout on social media that Jo Malone had done something and she got so much hate. So
it's a really good question, and it does throw up lots of interesting issues. We've seen it a lot, particularly in the cosmetics industry, with Bobbi Brown, Liz Earle, you've correctly referred to Jo Malone, Karen Millen also had issues with this. I think often to influencers, it's very attractive to use their own name because obviously that's what they've been known by. That's the name that they've been operating under. And so that's where their goodwill ultimately sits. Where it becomes problematic is if you look to sell that name in the future, you are effectively then selling your name to a third party who will then be able to carry on that business and use your name however they want to use it. And that can be really difficult if you don't actually like what the brand is now proposing to the brand direction that they want to take it, you know, and you really don't have any control over it because you've sold it. So that's definitely something to consider. However, there are benefits to it. You know, I mentioned before that that's the name you're known by, so it seems sort of an obvious choice, but also initially it can feel less risk averse because you're already out there using it. There are also defences to trademark infringement if you're using your own name. So actually there is that benefit too, that it may be less risky initially to go ahead and use your own name rather than creating something new, which might expose you to potential infringement risks if you haven't properly searched before you go ahead and use.
Yeah.
But I think it's just really important that anyone wanting to do that does think about the future, where they might want to take their brand with. Very often the issue is that you sell, for example, your clothing business, which takes your own name, and actually you then want to go off and run a cosmetics business. And obviously it may well be in the contract that in the purchase agreement that you had with the buyer of the brand, that you can't then go on and use your name for a cosmetics business. So it's just being alive to those issues at the outset and making sure that you make an informed choice as to whether that's the right thing, right decision for your brand, to use your own name or to create something new.
Isn't there something called like passing off?
So passing off is protects unregistered rights in the UK. So if you don't register your trademark, but you have been using that trademark in the course of business for a number of years, or even, you know, for quite a short time, but quite extensively, and you can evidence that you've got UK custom, then you may well be able to show that you've got goodwill in that sign, such that that would enable you to prevent other people from using or registering something similar. So that can also be a really useful tool as well.
But ideally, you'd like to trademark it. So once you've come up with your name, then you go about protecting it and filing, and that's trademarks and, you know, copyright. And
yeah, so trademarks tends to be the kind of the main one. Actually, in the UK, you you can't register copyright. You can in some jurisdictions, you can in the US and you can in China, but we don't in the UK. Copyright in the UK subsists automatically in the content or image or whatever it might be once you've created it. So in that sense, it's free, but you do really need to keep accurate records of the creative process to ensure that if you ever need to evidence your copyright, that you're able to do that. So effectively keeping accurate records of how you came up with the idea, any prototypes, any design documents, the date of creation, making sure that you've got all that safely recorded so that if you ever need to rely on it, you've got that evidence to hand. And that's also really important actually for evidencing unregistered design rights as well.
I was at an event fairly recently, and just because I know Intangible Threads and particularly your interest is in sustainable fashion brands, and that we are seeing more sustainable companies launching, but then are there any sort of protections in place to prove that you're sustainable? Because in, say, the food industry, this is what they were discussing at the event, it's actually a firm called Provenance who do proof points about how ethical, you know, carbon, you can register your brand and have lots of different proof points. But are there seem to be quite a few fashion brands that talk about or infer perhaps that they're more sustainable than they are. Is that a big problem, do you think?
Greenwashing.
Yes, that's it.
Yes, so that is a really big issue in the fashion industry, and as you've mentioned, Alice, not just limited to the fashion industry. I think really for consumers what's important is looking for industry recognised certifications. So for example, if you're a B Corp company and you've been given B Corp status, then you would have had to go through a fairly rigorous set of kind of testing and standards to ensure that your company actually does meet B Corp standards. But I think there are a lot of woolly, fluffy statements used by companies which allude to some sort of sustainability practices, but actually aren't bedded in any regulatory framework or industry recognised certification standards. And I think that's partly because sustainability has become such a buzzword in the fashion industry. All companies want to be sustainable. It's what consumers want, it's what consumers are looking for. And I think actually, if you're not sustainable these days, if you're not a sustainable fashion brand and you're not seen to be putting these practices in place, then that actually looks pretty bad to a consumer.
Yeah, yeah. And then finally, my final question, if I am a creator, or we're just looking at creators, and they want to get in touch with you, is that something, you know, do they drop you an email, or what position should they be in before they think about getting in touch with Stobbs?
Yeah, so we really welcome contact from anyone at any stage or in any position, any stage of the creative process, if they're just starting out on their journey or if they are further along their journey and are now looking for ways in which they can expand and monetize or develop their brand. We can assist at all stages of that journey, and as I've said, and you know, at Stobbs we're really wanting to be an inclusive law firm, an inclusive advisory firm that assists every type of creative person, every type of brand person. So if you've got a question or you want further advice on any of the issues that we've discussed, I really would encourage you to drop me a line. My email address is on our website at iamstobbs.com, and my name's Harry Berridge, so you can look me up and feel free to reach out to me if you'd like further advice.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. I actually do have one more question, which, even though the last was my final, so I apologise for that, which was, are there any fashion brands that you're working with that you think our audience should check out? And are you following any creators in particular? And what recommendations do you have?
That's a really good question. On a personal level, I am always looking at sustainable fashion brands and kind of following those brands, following trying to follow creative people that will introduce me to those brands. And one of my favourites at the moment is an East London based brand called Meadows Store. And I really like the branding around it. It's kind of quite folky, quite hippie vibes, and I just really love the fabrics and the kind of look and feel of the brand.
You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. For more influencer industry updates, be sure to check out www.blogospheremagazine.com.